got the fire and the fury at his command.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, Revolutionary Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM. Big shout out to my co-hosts, Damon Azali, Tammy Liu, Emmanuel Criollo, who all are big fans of The Wire. And we're very lucky today. We have another, this is The Wire Part 2. Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. My name is Eric Mann. I'm your host for the show today. So last week, this is part two. Last week we had actress Sonia Sohn, who played Detective Shakima Kima Greggs, and writer Rafael Alvarez. So we had them last week. And this week we're very lucky because we have Wendell Pierce, who plays Detective Bunk Moreland on The Wire, and Andre Royo, who plays Bubbles on The Wire. As we discussed, Wendell's from New Orleans and also Brooklyn, and Andre's from the Bronx, and I'm from Brooklyn, so here we are, a bunch of New Yorkers. Wendell Pierce, he plays Detective Bunk Moreland on The Wire, originally from New Orleans. He's acted in numerous films such as Get on the Bus, Waiting to Exhale, and Spike Lee's 2006 HBO documentary When the Levees Broke. Andre Royo plays Bubbles on The Wire. Originally from the Bronx, New York City, Royo is a regular in the film festival circuit. He wrote a short film called Andre Royo's Big Scene, which drew acclaim at the Pan-African Film Festival, which we all go to here. He's been featured in television shows such as Strong Medicine and Cuts. So welcome, brothers. We're happy to have you both. We're going to take a short break with some music and then start the questions.
All right, perfect. You can play that Wire theme song over and over again, too.
They probably will.
Keep the devil way down in the hole. Down in the hole. Down in the hole. You gotta help me keep the devil.
Hey, everybody. So we're back. So Wendell Pierce, isn't it strange that you walk down the street now and everybody thinks they know you? I mean, they come up with that strange kind of, hi, Bunk.
Right. You know, but actually, first it's, hey, man, where I know you from?
You know? Is that right?
It's where I know you from. And then, you know, they think I either went to high school with him or owe him money or something like that. And then eventually I say, no, I'm an actor. And they're like, and what? And then I say, The Wire. Oh, Bunk! Yeah, so it takes a little while.
It does. Well, it didn't
the
take
familiarity us. Is cool, though.
But I think one of the things that's interesting about being an actor is you say, no, I'm Wendell Pierce. You know, I'm not Bunk. So, for instance, like, do you drink that much in front of the cars at midnight?
I don't do it in front of the cars, but, see, I'm from New Orleans, and, you know, New Orleans is just a breeding ground of drunks. And there's a different, you know, alcoholic is someone who needs to drink. Drunks are people who just love to drink. And, I'm from New Orleans. I'll admit that.
Well, in terms of your own character development, in the fifth season, you had to do a lot of kind of rolling your eyes at McNulty. You know what I mean? Like, what's he up to? But what was you think the meatiest part of your part in terms of the five seasons? Where did you like your own part the most?
Wow. This season... This season, I was just proud of the fact that, you know, Bunk's moral compass was dead on. As deflicted and dysfunctional as he is as a human being, as a father, a drunk, a husband, the one thing he is sure about is his police work. And he felt as though, and you know, while his moral compass was challenged, he stayed, you know, dead on and certain. And actually, that's the thing that actually... survives through all the turmoil, and I think that's the thing that helps the friendship survive too.
Yeah, well, the thing is that, I was given a note to give some background to those few people who don't know what The Wire is. Now, see what I mean, Andre?
It's a shame, man.
It's a shame.
That's
we have to start there. I'm not sure I want to agree with that.
I think, you know what? We are in L.A. right now.
Yeah, so
I don't know. Maybe West Coast.
Yeah,
West Coast. I don't know if they got love for us like that over here.
Let's put it this way. I think what we're going to say is if you haven't watched it, listen.
DVDs are in stores all four seasons.
All right. So here's the thing. In terms of that moral compass, you know, you have, isn't it interesting how everybody got implicated, right? This is, in this particular scene, McNulty is basically trying to dream up a serial killer that doesn't exist for the allegedly good intention of getting more cops on the street against the bad guys as opposed to the false murderer. And get
the necessary resources to put the case together for the 22 bodies we discovered the previous year.
That's right, which were been locked into old houses and boarded up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an interesting moral dilemma. But then he gets Lester involved, right? And then he gets how many eventually, because each one says, yeah, I'm in on it too. How many ended up being in on it?
Sid Noor was in on it, Lester. And then he basically gets the entire department involved because so many people understand that he's doling out. Once he gets the money coming
in,
he starts to dole it out to anybody who can come up with an excuse.
I know one of the great scenes was this, I think it's a white guy who says, well, I got to go to this trip to North Carolina, check out my condo or something. He says, well, that's not a legitimate police business. He says, hey.
If you don't give me the money, I'm going to bust you.
Right. So he says, all right, go investigate some murder that was 11 years ago, right?
Right, while he plays golf in Hilton Head.
And I did think your moral compass was, you know, that was a good part for you.
Because that was the whole journey from all 5 years, you know. I felt as though the show started and it actually investigates moral ambiguity,
right?
You know. In all the institutions, whether it's, you know, the organized street or the police department, city hall, the media. So there's always this moral ambiguity in how the individual is lost in the institution. And I felt at the end of that journey, Bunk stood strong for his own individual morality. And his moral compass stayed true north.
No, it was good. And Andre, before you got here or before we got on the radio, we were talking about the precarious dance of the wire to even get through all the different things, which I didn't, you know, because I came in season three, sort of got it, but didn't get it. And season four got totally hooked and, you know, four and five just went wall to wall. Now I'm starting from the beginning. But why don't you tell us a little bit about how those of us who do know that The Wire finished 5 years on HBO, very, very successful. Now everybody's talking about it like, you know, now that it's off even, it's getting more attention, right?
They always miss you when you're gone.
Right, that's right. Now everybody's analyzing every past issue. So, Andre, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the show and then its precarious dance to get to season five.
Well, you know, I got on the show, as most of the listeners out there in all of L.A., all the actors know, I got on the show by just auditioning. I heard about it, and once I got the gig, you know, I talked to the creators of the show, David Simon, Ed Burns, and Bob Colesbury, who passed away. But they always had in their mind the concept of five seasons for the show. And, you know, with that instilled, we all wanted to see that whole journey all the way through to the end. But, you know, it was hard for HBO to get a grasp of our audience. You know, they were doing ratings by, you know, who's watching on Sunday at 10 o'clock.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of people know that HBO repeats on Monday and Wednesday, 11 o'clock on Sunday. So it was hard for them to really gauge where our audience was by the numbers. So every season, you know, even though people in the streets were talking about it, you know, the powers that be didn't really feel that we were a strong enough show that can be guaranteed, like other shows, 3 seasons in advance. They would always had us on a year-by-year basis. And every year, it just seemed like we were on the cusp of not making it. You know, not for lack of storytelling or lack of acting, just by, you know, a numbers game of not knowing are there viewers out there. Until the DVD first season came out and sold like over 300,000, something like that. That's when they realized, oh, there is an audience out there. Now we got to find a way to get them or to count them. And then when HBO Demand came, then they realized it was easier for them to see by the on-demand count that a lot of people are out there watching The Wire. But it was always very, very nervous, even for the actors. Mm-hmm. You know, for the first season, I didn't know the show was going to be accepted that well because, you know, the audience out there knew what a cop show looked like, and we were giving them a different look. And, you know, we were a little worried that they might not stay for that long journey of seeing a whole case per season instead of the bad guy getting caught at the end of the hour.
And David had so much trust and faith in the audience because he trusted the pace of the show, which is slow.
Right.
He always said, you know, it's not audience friendly. The first three shows, the first three episodes, people are not going to be into it, and then it's going to hook them. He trusted that people wanted to see something detailed and developed and broadened like a novel. And he always said that it was a visual novel. And then at the same time, the faith that they would come back when you change the case every year, which is totally different from any other, anthology show, which, you know, kind of make sure they spoon feed you all the way through to make sure you stay hooked. You know, I mean, he would change up a whole series of discussions, a whole A storyline every year. And HBO was just thrown by that. And they said, are people going to come back? And he said, if you give them compelling stories and characters, they will. And he proved that.
With Andre Royo and Wendell Pierce, you know, Andre is, quote, Bubbles, you know, Wendell as Bunk. I mean, this is fundamentally a show about cops and gangs. You know, that's sort of the core of the dramatic tension. And one thing I think is interesting is, I think one of the reasons why the show is difficult is, I don't think America likes angry black people. You know, I think that there's like a...
No, really? That this
right?
week.
Right, that's right. We saw that this week.
We saw that this week.
With the Reverend, right? With the,
what are you angry about, Rev?
Right, I don't know. Gee, you know. So angry black people really scare white people and even scare maybe a few black people. But, you know, mainly white people just don't... They like, you know, they have their own image of who they want. And to see also angry armed black people. So, you know, and really poor people in the projects, you know. We do some organizing in low-income—I mean, our organization mainly does organizing in low-income communities. And there was some time where I was watching the show and thinking, I'm scared. Mm-hmm. Not scared to not watch the show, but this is serious, this level of violence in the community. So how did you, Andre, when you're in the playing Bubbles, you're living in a—one time you're living below your sister's place. Sometimes you live in just—I don't know where you're living.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did you get really into, because you got into that part. How did you get into that part? How did you become Bubbles?
You know, I'm an actor, you know, and I trust my instincts, and I went out there and prepared myself, did a lot of research, hung out with a young lady by the name of Fran Boyd, who they based The Corner, one of their first miniseries that they came out with, and it was about, you know, drug addicts and living a life under the addiction of drugs. And she took me around, and I just talked and sat down with people and talked to them and understood and listened, you know, listened to what they had to say and what they were feeling. And, you know, I just took that into my own psyche. And being in Baltimore, you know, shooting, you know, one of David Simon's great gifts is shooting on set, you know, and shooting on location and just having people around and having non-actors, you know, come on and play extra parts on the show. I mean, it just felt so real that it just became, you know, and after that, you just be.
Also, you know, Andre is an actor. He's a craftsman. You know, the byproduct of our work is entertainment, but we're not entertainers. You know, he's an artist who creates a reality so strong that it induces the behavior. He's a student of human behavior. He's a psychologist. And all of that work, all that intellectual and visceral work, it's the catalyst for all the behavior and the stuff that you see. And what happens is in America, so many people can get on air just by doing nothing, you know. In Los Angeles, you put out a sex tape, you're number one at the movies next week. And that's not the form in which we as actors were working in The Wire. And especially someone like Andre, because I've been a big fan of his work forever. And he always hears me say this, but I can never say it enough. Because he is so far away from Bubbles that you actually see the craftsmanship. And in America, we've lost the sense of what art is as the form in which we as a community reflect on where we're going, what thoughts are to the individual. Art is for the community as a whole. And then he was able to tap into that forum and make people see the humanity and people that they don't give that credit to all the time. They can never pass someone hanging out on the corner or a junkie or someone struggling with addiction and never understand their humanity the way that he has exposed it to him. And that is the gift that he, Andre Royo, gave to the audience.
Yeah, that was, I was going to say that, but thank you. I was about to, but, you know, I'm always, you know, that's one of the great things about the show is we were surrounded by so many great actors, and not only actors, but just good friends that really cared mm-hmm. about the story and really felt like this was an important subject matter and story to be told, that when we came on the set, everybody brought their A game. Everybody was prepared. Everybody was on top of understanding that we were storytellers and we wanted to tell the story right.
It's Eric Ben. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK, 90.7 FM. I'm here with Andre Royo and Wendell Pierce. When I watched the show, first of all, I love slow. I love slow because slow to me is what's the opposite? Action hero? I mean, life is slow. Conversation is slow. A relationship is slow. But watching you all, and I mean you all, I was struck by the acting. I was struck by every nuance of the facial mechanism, every little thing thinking, and I'm good at a lot of things. And what I thought is I could not do that. This is acting. You know, I mean, there's areas where I have some expertise. And if people don't know this is great acting, which is what you were saying, Wendell, you know, if people think that it's just he's sort of playing a junkie as opposed to watching Bubbles, every move, every facial expression when you, I think, tell whoever you tell is that you're going to give him, he's going to give you a cell phone and he's going to call you back and protect right. you, but mm-hmm. you then you get the stuff beat out of you anyway. And
yeah.
even the tragedy of trying to sell that junk, you know, and they're always getting ripped off in the community and your facial expression. What I was saying to you, Wendell, is even the multiple ways of raising your eyebrows with McNulty, you know, just those little like, oh, no, I don't believe he's going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that one of the great things about The Wire is raising people's consciousness about black actors?
First of all, I got to give props to Andre also with that because he recognized that in the first season. He said, we have to get together and show people that this is the first time you've ever seen a huge, diverse pool of this much talent of actors of color
yeah.
in one show. And he put together this photo shoot of all the black actors in that first one. And now, actually, 5 years later, we need to do another
one. It's grown.
Because it's grown. David had an interesting point. He said, you know, that's the reason we didn't get the acclaim. Because, you know, like white flight when it comes to the neighborhood, you know, it's proven.
right.
It's proven. You get to 7% of the neighborhood, white folks start to leave, right. you know. And we have more than 7% actors of color on the show. And he felt as though white viewers started to left. But it was an interesting evolution. People are always interested in characters that reflect them. So a lot of white audience members were there. Second season, when we went to the docks, and it was predominantly
right.
white cast in that storyline. But then they stayed because they saw the humanity in everyone. And then that audience just broadened more and more and more. And actually, one of the cast members said, at the beginning of the run, Brothers and Sisters will stop you in New York, man, love this show. He said, now at the end of the run, everyone stops us, brothers, sisters, the white pilot on the airplane that you just jumped onto, kids who shouldn't be looking at it, to grandmothers who you wouldn't expect to look at that. And it just shows you, it says a lot about American television audiences that they want to see something challenging and adult. That's the thing that was so so moving about the show, coming to a conclusion that it reminded us that we should have faith in the American public because they want to see something that's challenging. And I think now, like yourself, you know, people got into the show fourth, fifth year, they're going to go back and look at all the DVDs from the beginning, and it's going to be so rich and layered how many people and how many characters are connected back to the first episode.
Right.
Even, you know, and so while the show is off the air, we will have many fans coming to it even after.
Well, one of the things the Labor Community Strategy Center is having our what we call our annual political party, which is Saturday, May 10th at the African American Museum. And the first prize for the person who sells the most tickets is the four-volume CD of The Wire, DVD
right.
of The Wire. So that's already – so
great.
Some people are already in the – as they speak, people are selling more tickets. Couple of questions. Well, I want to talk about David Simon in a minute, just because you reference him a lot, and he is an interesting figure. One question is, for those of us who are organizers, we wish there was another character in the wire, which was the civil rights organizer, which you had the press, mm-hmm. you had the community, you had the gangs, but what it would have been like if there was some kind of a community organization coming in that was critical of the police, that was critical of police brutality, that was critical of the mayor. In other words, there was a voice missing there between Mr. She, you know, him, you know, who he was good. But did you find that a missing piece in the show?
Well, I felt that David was writing what he knew. And I know that he was in that world of cops and robbers, for right. lack of a better phrase, all the years as he was a reporter. And Bill Zorzi was in the world of the media. And Ed Burns, these are all producers
right,
and
exactly
writers, was
right.
You know, a police officer who then went to the schools. So I really felt as though if it was just touched upon at times when, you know, people would say, you come into our communities, you know, you see a community meeting every once in a while, or one person saying you're not doing something that's really affecting us, when Carchetti actually had
right.
some consciousness. So I felt as though it was lacking in that, that they didn't know anyone in depth. But, you know, that's the reason for the movie.
Yeah.
That's what I always say.
I want to say, you know, there was one person who we lost, Bob Colesbury,
right.
who was one of the producers, and he produced a movie called Mississippi Burning.
Right.
And I'm sure if he would have still been around while we shot mm-hmm. the rest of the season, we might have saw more of the civil activist, maybe sprinkled within the storylines, I believe, seeing his work and understanding when I talked to him how much he really cared about community and cared about. You know, he was one of the guys that really helped with the tone of the show by really establishing that a lot of wide shots was part of the wire look, because mm-hmm. he wanted people to get drawn into the community. We don't need close-ups of everybody's face and close-ups of this and that. He really wanted everybody to really take in Baltimore as much as they could, so they can feel and understand what this city, like any other city out there, is going through and how it's being, you know, destroyed in many ways. You know, and I also believe that, you know, as a creator of a show, you create something like The Wire in hopes not that you're going to be the last of The Wire. You hope that this really, you know, invokes other people to believe that if they have thoughts of creating a show like this, it can make its way on air. Mm-hmm. It can make its way to viewers. So I think, you know, with The Wire being over, you know, there's a lot of things that people want to hear and people want to discuss and talk about. And hopefully, you know, we've sparked other writers to not be afraid or not feel the necessary attitude to dumb things down to get on air.
And so, it also spawned, I would like to think that it spawned activism also, that the very thing that we may not have demonstrated in the show, the reaction to the show, actually spawned activism. Because I remember when we came back to shoot the fifth season, there were a bunch of school kids who went down to City Hall in protest of the education they had been receiving.
Hmm.
And they said it was inadequate and that we can speak for ourselves, saying this is what we want. And I would like to believe that sit-in was because of the fourth season of The Wire. You know, and, you know, as we held that mirror up to nature, as Shakespeare said, to show the city in a dysfunction of our communities as they are. I also know that it spawns the conversation because of New Orleans. I'm the president of my neighborhood association, Pontchartrain Park. And I go to New Orleans on the weekends to do, you know, my neighborhood community organizing work. And I recently went to a Policy Link summit in New Orleans, and I was greeted like a rock star. I mean, I literally had never received that. And it was just filled with thousands of people that do that sort of work.
That's right.
And they were talking about how the show, they use the show as the catalyst for a lot of their discussions and a lot of interacting, you know. And they also taught me, as I'm becoming more of an activist, you know, and an organizer. You know, I'm learning about everything, yep. You know, community benefit agreements. And, you know, I was like, you can actually tell them that you want that. Oh, okay, cool. Right. You know, I can do this. So it has set the stage for a lot of discussions to move people to activism.
Well, that's great. I'm working on a book now called Revolutionary Organizing in the Age of Reaction. And it's mm-hmm. built on a lot of my organizing from CORE in 1964 to the Bus Riders Union today. So it's great you go from being an actor and not you're an actor and you played a policeman and now you're a community organizer in New Orleans. So we're going to take a short break. This is Eric Mann. I'm with Andre Royo, Wendell Pierce, two very fine people who you're getting to see in a lot of their facets. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM. This is Voices from the Front Lines. We'll be out, and then we'll be back in. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. And I'm talking with Wendell Pierce and Andre Royo, who are both actors, very fine actors, from a five-year series called The Wire. So I am going to try to, why don't we all take a few minutes to set it in perspective. In fact, why don't you, Andre, why don't you start? If folks have never seen it yet, why don't you give a short synopsis of what is The Wire and what are we talking about here?
We're talking about a Baltimore-based cop drama that started on HBO like 6 years ago. And it just grew into a movement of, I guess, pretty much saying, you know, all the pieces matter in a community, in the destruction or the rehabilitation of individuals in a community. It starts from, you know, all different facets of their lives, from the cops to education to political to media. And we try to cover all bases. And now I'll pass off to Mr. Wendell Pierce.
Yeah, it was an artistic television series that really depicts for the first time, in my opinion, the true dysfunction of urban cities and how you cannot assume that all the parts of this working metropolis don't affect each other. And it's also dealing with the moral ambiguity of people in all those institutions. And the institutions were the drug culture on the street, drug gangs on the street, the police officers, City Hall, the media, and just the criminal dysfunction of our schools. And those were all the elements and all the parts of the city that we really investigated in 5 years on the show.
And the show opens with a scene of a young gang member who's shot on the street, and then Detective McNulty is talking to one of the gang kids and says, who's the kid? And he says, his name's Snot. So they go into a whole riff about how he got the name, and then they say, well, what do you think happened? He says, well, every time we play dice, Snot will come in and steal the money. So he says, and I don't know why, now there's the black kid speaking. He says, I don't know why they shot him. They should have beat him up like we always do. So McNulty says, but I don't understand. He says, if he steals the money every time, why do you keep letting him back in the show? And the kid says, because this is America. Right. So right there with the opening, it's like, hey, right. Stealing and coming back. And, you know, right. This is America, free enterprise.
There's no judgment on what you do and how you do it. You just got to deal with the ramifications.
Right.
And that metaphor right there is a perfect example of how The Wire kind of showed the dysfunction of urban America.
So in the first 3 minutes, if you didn't get that this is not NYPD blue, then then you didn't get it. And I think it also shows, you know, for those of us who fought against the police most of our life, which is me and all the people at the Strategy Center, it showed a pretty complex view of the police, including everything from their fights over overtime, you know, how big overtime is to them. And those people who, you know, I think one of the interesting things Simon was trying to show is the phoniness of the war on drugs. And when Carchetti asked to do a roundup and went along with them, they beat up they found every little kid with a dime bag or something like that to make arrests.
Right, just so they can show that they're flexing.
Right, and develop some numbers.
It also, you know, that's the thing about the show. It showed the complexity because, you know, I'm right along there with you with, you know, the relationship with police and the community has always been tortured, to say the least. And but the interesting thing for me playing a cop for 5 years is the element that I found with black officers specifically who became police because they said the crime in their neighborhoods didn't reflect the neighborhood that they knew because they grew up in it. And that's the reason they became cops. And there was a relationship, you know, a very thin line between, you know, going down one road of criminality or deciding to become a police officer. And we tapped into that with our, my relationship with Omar, who was this, you know, pathological killer, you know, one of the most feared characters in The Wire.
Right.
Who, to show you his moral ambiguity, would never curse. He had a moral code, but he was a killer. And we discovered that we went to the same high school. And that was something that we wanted to investigate of how black officers come from these neighborhoods. You know, and there but by the grace of God go I. And that doesn't reflect the 90% of people who are, you know, hardworking, you know, law-abiding citizens. You know, the crime in those neighborhoods don't reflect what they do every day by getting up, going to work, trying to raise their kids. And at the same time, they are disproportionately affected by the crime. So you have all of these African-American officers that I met who became officers so they can protect that neighborhood they knew was not being protected properly. And it's a very interesting dilemma because which ones become corrupt and become that while they're going to the job with one mission, they become that, you know, that bleeding blue officer who treats those same kids with the disrespect and brutality that they don't, that they went into to the force to protect them against. You know, so that's the sort of complexity to The Wire that we're
absolutely
dealing with.
Yeah, and it kind of showed, you know, it kind of showed in a weird way because, you know, my neighborhood, grew up in the Bronx, same thing. You know, when I saw a cop, I didn't think about the man first. I thought about the uniform, and it was just a negative connotation. I fit a description. I had an attitude with them, and I just felt that no matter how they looked at me, it was going to be an unfair judgment on their part. And then with The Wire and looking at it and understanding that there are some cops out there who really want to, you know, do good and all the stuff they have to deal with. With the, you know, bureaucracy and the red tape, which it seems to make their job harder and harder and unfulfilling, you know, while, you know, the criminals, you know, since they don't play by any rules, get to do whatever, it just turns a couple of people cold. And it made me understand that, you know, there are good cops out there and there is a purpose for, you know, the law to be out there. You just never know what side of the law you're getting when they hit the streets. And it's an incredible job. I mean, when they were going out scouting with the cops, it's an amazing psyche to really drive around these type of neighborhoods or in the city and know that, you know, you can get shot at any given moment or whatever you do is being scrutinized by, you know, the mayors and the governors, you know, and all you're trying to do is better your community. So it's a great outlook.
Now, we're not absolving them, you know, of, you know, their improper behavior. The thing that about The Wire is we start to see the ambiguity on all sides, but the common thread is the humanity. The common thread is the humanity. We all want to have a better quality of life.
Yeah.
That's an instinct. It's impossible to wake up in the morning and go, I want to destroy my life. Every choice people are making, right and wrong, are actually trying to improve their quality of life. That's a natural order of life and, you know, and law and human nature. And if we could understand and give people the benefit of the doubt that they have that humanity and we share that. So let's find that common ground to get there and know that you can be right and wrong and you have to check yourself on your behavior, then things can improve. And if they don't improve, at least we try to, on the show, show the dysfunction so people can maybe think about how they are dealing. What's their contribution to this messed up dynamic?
And one of the things I just wanted to bring in that in terms of the conflict is that for a lot of us in the movement, you have to understand that we have been infiltrated by police. Fred Hampton, who I'm sure you know about, was shot to death by a police informer, first of all, a black police informer, unfortunately, who was sent into the Panthers.
Who openly talks about it.
Right. He's at least has some remorse, thank God, you know, and he openly talks about it. He told the police exactly where Fred was going to be shot. Mark Clark was shot at the same time. Malcolm X, when I went to the Malcolm X Museum, one of his bodyguards was NYPD undercover.
Gene Washington.
Right?
The last photograph of a man giving him mouth-to-mouth was an NYPD officer undercover who had infiltrated the organization.
And so what we're hoping for, you know, I mean, two things we're pushing for is, first of all, the massive decriminalization of a lot of these things, because right now, as you know, there were 35,000 kids in the California prisons. Now there's 180,000. 2 million people in prison in the United States, 2.3 million, over a million of whom are black. Mm-hmm. And most of it is picking up people for things that shouldn't be crimes. So, you know, I mean, it's that once you determine there's a law, then the police officer, you know, so that's why, if I can hop to this, that I thought David Simon's argument about nullification, I don't know if you read that, he did an article in Time magazine saying, if we can't get rid of the war on drugs, then people who should go on juries should just not convict kids for possession.
Right.
He said, even if the evidence says the other way, if you just say I'm not going to do the conviction, it was just at least one idea for an actual set of actions, and it's pretty gutsy for him to say that.
I think jury nullification is a powerful, powerful move. You know,
white people used it all the time, right?
They did it all the time in the South. And the fact is, we're actually to the point in Louisiana, where I'm from. You literally can call to your parish prison, your county prison, or a jail, and say, give me two inmates to come and cut my lawn for $1 an hour. I mean, that's anywhere in the state, you know. So it is modern-day slavery.
That's right.
And if you are allowing that sort of thing to happen, we don't have time to try to convince you that it's wrong. We have to be as bold and as gangster, as some people say it, in changing it. And the way you do that is jury nullification. I don't care what your reaction is. Guess what? We're not going to put them down. And people are forced to deal with the fact that they are using our jails as modern day plantations, especially in Louisiana. They've lifted the veil. Most of the prison lobby for the private prisons down there lobby against any education reform because they are also students of human behavior, like we are as actors.
That's right.
They know that the only way they make money is if they have a prisoner. The only way they keep an inmate is to make sure he creates a crime. You have a criminal class. The only way you create a criminal class is to make sure you don't educate people. I mean, if you don't have an education, you don't have a way, the first thing you're going to do is just do anything to make a way. And that's usually going to send you to jail. And so they're going to make their money. And so, you know, even to this day in Punch Train Park, where I am, the first thing they want to do in this greatest urgent time of rebuilding is to tear down our school. That's the first thing they want to do. Before we rebuild anything, before we do any sort of infrastructure work or anything, we're going to close the school. Because this is the thing I learned growing up in New Orleans. There are people who don't have my best interest at heart. And I think that people who are part of the movement, we have evolved to the point where we don't have to educate those who don't have our best interest at heart. We just need to do the things that are necessary to improve our lives. Jury nullification is something that does that.
Well, I'll get you in, you know, when we went to New Orleans, this is Wendell Pierce, who you just heard, speaking beautifully, if I could say. When we went to New Orleans, one of the things that was kind of shocking to me is we saw the housing projects. They looked in pretty good shape. We saw a lot of schools. They were in pretty good shape. But we got a tour from some of the organizers, and these housing projects were not the massive high rises that they pretend.
Right,
they were three and four stories. And we went in there and they said, why are they closing them down for $100,000 each, or $150,000, or if, God forbid, $500,000? You could do a whole regut of the structure.
Now, just for clarification,
yeah, sure.
For people always ask me, why did those people stay? If you don't have $700 to drop for a little out-of-town weekend trip, right, but you know you live on the third floor of the projects, the worst-case scenario could happen, and you're going to be cool. Because, you know, if the city floods, I'm going to be stranded. But my whole apartment is going to be cool. I'm going to be safe. That's why you saw people on their balconies waving. Those were poor folks who couldn't leave. Now, once they did leave, they were never allowed back into their homes. And those are the homes that were looted. And then the federal government held us hostage because they have destroyed all of those public housing with no written guarantee to rebuild them, none whatsoever. I asked city council members, why'd you do that? They said the federal government said this $100 million next payout you don't get unless you approve taking down those projects. That's somebody who doesn't have our best interests at heart. So you won't give New Orleans $100 million until you tear down the projects for poor folks where they are asking to move back into. No guarantee to rebuild them. But yet today we're going to bail out Bear Stearns at $100 million? Today? My tax dollars went to that? That's criminal. I'm sorry. I'm going
to
shut up.
No. That's good. In fact, we'd like to bring you over to the Strategy Center
yes.
and hook you up. And this is great. Andre, let me ask you this. I mean, understand if I don't mind if I just ask you some of the harder questions, because on the positive, which is very positive, the evolution of your character on The Wire was pretty incredible, right? And the ability for you, for instance, so it's a two-part question.
Okay.
The first part is the transition from being a drug addict to not. But the second question is, what did you think about having to be an informant?
Okay, well, the first question, you know, being a drug addict or not isn't the question. I mean, we all have addictions, you
right,
know, cigarette
right.
smoking, drinking, you know, too much TV, sex addiction, which is one of my favorites. We all have addictions, and they don't go away. You just
right.
learn to live with the control over that addiction. And, you know, Bubbles will always be an addict,
right.
but he's a recovered addict. You know, he will always deal with that sort of feeling, but he's found a way at the end of this, you know, at the end of this journey to know that and move on from it. And that was just, you know, I'm always blessed to have the opportunity to play that journey and play that arc. I have a lot of people that come up to me and say, that was my story.
Hmm.
You know, I've been through that. You know, I've been through that journey and you played it dead on. So I have great gratitude in my ability, and I thank God for giving me that gift to enjoy that journey and put it out there. As far as being a snitch, you know, it's funny when I got the role, you know, a snitch. I mean, just the sound of it had a negative connotation. You know, of course, growing up, you know, mark of a squealer, scratch across the face, and everything. It didn't stick with Bubbles because Bubbles wasn't really, you know, the real term of snitch is betraying your fellow friends, or betraying your crew. If you're rolling with a crew and you're all doing dirt, and then you cop out when y'all get caught and drop a dime on them, you're a snitch. But if somebody saw a woman being raped or a crime being committed and told the cops, I saw that, you're being a concerned citizen. You know, and Bubbles, the real life Bubbles, stayed alive. He was Ed Burns' informant. You know, they didn't bother, you know, people knew what Bubbles was doing, and they didn't take the time out to say, let's kill him. He's already killing himself. And it wasn't, you were more dumb to do dirt in front of Bubbles, you know, because you knew that he was going to say something to somebody to get his fix. So, you know, I was worried about it, but I don't feel the snitch. People, after the second season, nobody came and said, yeah, you that snitch. They was like, no, you Bubbles, I hope you make it. You
right.
know, people really had a, you know, an effect, you know, they really cared about him. You know, Kima Greggs, one of the cops, you know, you think we have this great relationship and we care about each other. And in one of the scenes when I asked her, you know, let me get some money, I want to recover, you know, her joke was, what am I going to do with a clean snitch?
Right, right.
You know, we don't need you clean. We need you, you know, whatever it takes for you to be out in the streets every day, we need that, you know. And it just showed that, you know, that aspect, you know, is a very loose term, and it doesn't really stick with everybody. Again, you have to betray somebody to be a snitch.
No, and I wasn't trying to, you know, this is a part. Just remember, I'm not. I'm
no, I'm just saying, though. No, I saw so the way you looked at me, you know.
No. No, this
what you trying to say, man? What you trying to say? Where's my boy Dre? What's up?
No, but, you know, it was weird, though. You know, there's certain roles, as a black actor, you know, out there in Hollywood, there's certain roles that you take that you feel or you were educated to believe were going to haunt you for the rest of your career.
Right.
You know, and that's why, you know, my character, you know, I really am proud that people really fell in love with my character and wanted him to make it. Omar's character, I think Michael Kenneth Williams took a very brave role and really portrayed it beautifully. And David Simon, you know, the way he orchestrated Omar coming out and being involved in the show was beautiful because, you know, being a, you know, playing a gay character on television, especially African American, has a negative connotation for a long time where you don't believe that person can be perceived in another movie playing a romantic comedy or doing something else because that stigma mm-hmm. of playing a gay character sticks onto you. And I think The Wire was great at doing that as well.
It was great how Michael evolved that because now you see cats and they go, man, I love Omar. I mean, you know, not like that.
Not that part.
But,
yeah.
You know, I don't love him like that, but, you know, that's my boy.
Well, the thing that's interesting here is that there's a lot of things interesting. It's wonderful having you both is that it's so fascinating about, like, your future career. Let's talk about that a little bit, that one of the things that happens is you go on a show, and at first, okay, it's a part. And, you know, could last 3 weeks for all you know, right? Or be canceled in the mid-screen, and maybe you get paid, and maybe you don't, based on however your contract was written. Then the second, third year comes around, and you really keep evolving the part. You keep, by the fourth and fifth year, the show does become iconic. And now all of a sudden everybody's hanging on your every word as if you're that character, right? And they're so identified with you that you're going to think, wait a minute, how get out of this part? Now that I'm into it, how do I get out? And I'm interested in both of you thinking about how do you begin to get out of being Bunk and how do you get out of being Bubble?
It's okay with me. You know, I'm so proud of being a part of this project. You know, I know. It's a very special feeling to actually know that something you're very proud of is going to be in my obit, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, I'm going to be known for this.
Yeah.
People always say, can I call you Bunk? And I say, feel free. It's not Gilligan.
Right.
You know? It would be a different story if
that's
it was
right,
Gilligan.
That's right.
You know, and so for me, I'm very proud of it. And I don't mind the fact that it'll be attached with me forever. It's I was working on a show and an actor came up to me and said, Wendell, you had your godfather. You know, actors hope for one project like that in their career that they know no matter what happens, I know that I achieved that sort of level of quality in the work and in the material and in the whole atmosphere and family. So I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm amazed, you know, when I hear people call me Bubbles and then in the last fifth season, I've had a lot of people come up to me and with joy in their face, call me Reginald, and they're happy to say Reginald.
Right.
Like they went on the journey with me, and you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I walked in. I never saw it coming. I never saw that this show would be this iconic and this powerful. Even as I was shooting every year, we're so close to and getting the job done that when we pulled back and saw everybody's reaction to it. It's kind of scary because, you know, this is my first TV, like, big stint.
Right.
And for it to be The Wire and it to be this, you know, this type of show, you know, for me, I'm a little nervous. You know, I don't know if I want anything else. You know, I mean, I know I want to work.
Right.
I know I need a job and I want to continue acting. But it's hard out there now when I read scripts or I discuss certain things or future projects. They have to be at a certain level now, and I don't know. I don't know if I can hold out for all that level to be accessible to me. You know, so I'm in a weird place right now. You know, I know that talent will always rise and be seen. I know that I will be seen more for my talent than the character I played, and that will get me more work. But I just hope that the work can stay at that level, because now that's the bar's been raised. And that's the level I like working in.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of fear in that because I'll admit to a part of that fear too, which is, are my best days behind me? You know, will I ever come in contact with material like this again? So there's a little bit of that fear, but I'm happy to embrace it.
Well, I think this is great because if I could say, I mean, two things that, you know, Charles S. Dutton at one awards, NAACP awards, said, please turn down shows that make us look foolish. You know, please, we cannot take every part, meaning black actors, you know, that there's too many degrading parts. And yes, we all want to work. And Charles S. Dutton, of course, is a brilliant stage actor, as good as you've ever seen him on TV. If you ever saw him in The Piano, like,
Piano Lesson,
that was like somebody came on the stage and just like ate the stage. I never saw it.
I had to follow him. I took over the role.
You're kidding.
Yeah, that's a little piece of trivia for you.
No, are you kidding?
But I played the role for like the final month.
Well, wait a minute. That's an honor. I mean, yes, it's both are true, right? Yeah. But still, that's great. Well, so the two things I was thinking was that, you know, Ralph Ellison, he spent his whole life saying, after Invisible Man, what do I do? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, how do you top one of the maybe 20 greatest books of all time?
Right.
So I think you're both being really, what I'm saying is very insightful in the following ways. One, to give you some feedback, don't get out that soon. I was saying, how do you get out of the part? But, you know, what Wendell's saying is, this is a part of a lifetime. Yep. And this is a 5-year part. It wasn't a walk-on. So it's going to be hard, but enjoy what you built, because some people will never build that again.
Right.
And the second thing is, it does, I'll give you some good news. You know, it's hard seeing Gandolfini, you know, I mean, but he gets past it. You know, he'll get another part, you know, right, and 3-4 years from now, you know, it won't be as much, you know, but you'll still know who he was, but you won't always say, oh, that's Tony Soprano. So being Bunk and being Bubbles, you're up there now in the, whatever it's called, you know, in the stratosphere, and enjoy it, because in life we get so ready to get ready for something, then some ready to leave something, we forget to occupy when we were in it.
Right.
Yeah.
So you both get. What do you want our audience to? What's your goodbye line, as far as where your mind is now? Being yourself. What are you thinking about now?
I'm. I mean, a lot of things, man. You know, like The Wire. You know, you have many layers. You have many different stories you want to tell. And I would like the audience to stay with me. You know, stay with the truth and stay with the honesty and whatever character I play, you will see that same humanity in any character I play, and just enjoy the journey. That's what I'm trying to do.
Sounds good.
And for me, you will be able to enjoy The Wire for years to come, because it is so layered. And now, when the DVDs come out, and as they're out now and the fifth season comes out, you'll be able to go back and enjoy it time and time again and pick up on things that you missed in the first, second, third viewing, like we do as actors, even a part of the show. So I'm happy that people stay with us this long. For those of you who haven't seen it, you will be able to join this motley crew of people who know that this show really tapped into something. And for those of you in the struggle, understand that true change comes from within. We are the change that we are seeking. We are the change that we are seeking. And we are all a part of that struggle. And don't forget us in New Orleans.
Well, Wendell Pierce, I want to thank you very, very much. Andre Royal, you know, we're going to see you again. We're going to try to bring you into some of the Strategy Center bus rides and activity, and have you meet some of the organizers that are some incredible frontline organizers who are saying, come on, Eric, you got to get them over to the Strategy Center. Mm-hmm. And we've done a lot of shows here, but I want to say that this has been one of the better ones in terms of your level of introspection and the level of politics. And you're two beautiful guys, and we really wish you both the very, very best, and you're going to land on your feet at least.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We had to represent Brooklyn. We all Brooklyn.
That's it. Brooklyn.
Thank you very much, man.
So this is Eric Mann, and I'm going to read you. Let's see here. So that ends today's program of Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. We'd like to thank our guests, Andre Royal and Wendell Pierce. You can listen to previous Voices show, including the one last week with The Wire, on www.thestrategycenter.org. And you can send comments to voices@thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, our production organizer, Lisa Adler, who organized this whole show, our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. What's happening, D'Angelo? And we'll see you next week for Voices from the Frontlines. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And this, again, it's been a real pleasure to be with the brothers from The Wire.
Thunder rolls. We just gotta keep the devil.